This is a production of Cornell University.
Hello, and welcome to the faculty forum of the Cornell University Cyber Tower. I'm Glenn Altshuler, the host of a monthly conversation with a member of our faculty. Today, I'm delighted that my guest is Jason Frank, the Gary Davis Professor of Government at Cornell, who's been here for about a half dozen years. So welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much for having me, Glenn.
Jason, I want to talk quite a bit today about the Founding Fathers, about whom you have written
something to say.
Quite a bit, about whom you have something to say. Perhaps as well about the book that that you have written called Constituent Moments. But why don't we begin by having you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and also how you became interested both in political science and political theory, and also
sure.
This topic.
I am a political theorist, not a historian, primarily, even though I do work on 18th century America. And I guess my interest came, I went to graduate school to get a PhD in political theory, really contemporary political theory, 20th century. And as I was beginning to think about a dissertation project, an earlier kind of love of mine in American political thought really took hold. And so I tried to figure out a way to write a dissertation that was kind of animated by the questions of contemporary political theory, and especially democratic theory. I really do a kind of democratic theory, while being historically situated. So the work, I describe the work that I do as historically inflected democratic theory. And there's, of course, a long history in political theory, kind of using history as a way to theorize politics, right? So you can think of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, Machiavelli's discourses on Livy's History of Rome. But I guess the most recent or more recent influence on me would be Hannah Arendt's work on the American and the French Revolution, On Revolution, which is a book that I have many disagreements with when it comes to especially her interpretation of the American Revolution, but as a general approach to political theorizing, kind of theorizing politics through historical examples that I am very taken by, and I think I've tried to kind of take some of her approach and use it in my own work.
There's a fascination and has been, I think, for some time with the founding generation, and the founders are much cited. I would say not always well understood.
Right.
Why do you think that is, Jason? Why? It hasn't always been the case. It's often been the case.
No, I mean, there's been a real variation over the course of American history in terms of what kind of authority is attributed to the founders. I mean, we're arguably living through a time now where the founders are enjoying a kind of unprecedented authority. But why I think that is, I mean, I think there are many reasons for that. It's in part the role that founding plays in Republican politics, where at the time of a political founding, the basic structures of a society or a constitutional order are laid down. And then within that kind of imaginary, the subsequent political history never dramatically breaks from those principles, but rather extends them over time as different political issues emerge because of social, economic, and cultural change. So there is a tendency to attribute a kind of special authority to these founding figures, the founders, the framers. I mean, the very language that we use to talk about them is bound up with their kind of super authoritative role that they play in democratic politics. You know, there are interesting tensions there, I think, within a democratic politics.
Yeah,
why?
When you're talking about authority in,
right.
in a democratic environment. In fact, let's just, before we return to to the founders per se, why don't we talk a little bit about some ideas that have emerged in your book, Constituent Moments.
Okay.
First of all, I'm intrigued. What is a constituent moment?
Okay, well, I'll define what a constituent moment is, and then I'll try to contextualize it a bit. I have a very pithy definition. I call a constituent moment a moment where claims to speak on the people's behalf, claims to speak in the people's name, so kind of a political set of claims, are effective, right? They have a kind of felicity. They work. They elicit a politics. They generate a movement of one sort or another, even though they explicitly break from the established channels for representing popular voice, right? So you have election, you have electoral systems set up that kind of channel the will of the people. We elect representatives, and those representatives are then authorized to speak on the people's behalf. But what I'm interested in are moments in American history where there is a claim to speak on the people's behalf that has some kind of effectivity, even though it explicitly breaks from those established channels of
representation. So what would be an example of that?
Well, an example, I mean, I talk about several of them in the book. For me, it's really a legacy of the American Revolution. This is one important legacy of the Revolution. So I'll give you an example, and then I'll try to set up why I think the Revolution sets this up as a possibility in subsequent American politics. In the 1790s, which is a very volatile decade in American political history, you have the emergence of these what are alternately called Jacobin clubs or Democratic Republican societies, societies that are not only influenced by the emergence of Jacobin clubs in revolutionary France, but similar associations in Britain at the time. But they also harken back to the revolutionary committees on correspondence and Sons of Liberty of the American revolutionary history itself. And these clubs, you know, what George Washington kind of derided as self-created societies, he held them largely responsible for the Whiskey Rebellion, but they were kind of self-created political associations that emerged kind of across the states in this period of time, and really claimed to be extra governmental checks on what they saw as abuses of governmental authority under Washington's administration. So these were kind of Republican associations before we had established political parties.
And they're checks because they're watchdogs.
You think about the Republican language of vigilance, right? That the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. These kind of ideas. The societies thought that kind of vigilance could only be fostered or elicited among a free citizenry if you had actual associations that claimed to speak on the people's behalf. It was a kind of claim to speak on the people's behalf above and beyond those who were officially elected by the people, those who held government office. It's very obvious to see why the Federalist administration was not very fond of these associations. But nonetheless, they did have a kind of effectivity. I mean, there are really interesting debates that emerged in the period over, questions like, and these are kind of unresolved questions in the period about who is the ultimate interpretive authority of constitutional law, for example. What role does the people play in a Republican, soon to be a more robustly Democratic politics after the elections have been held, right? And these are kind of unresolved questions. And these Democratic Republican societies, I take a kind of example of a constituent moment because they claim to speak on the people's behalf, even though they break from the established kind of electoral mechanisms that were set up for representing popular authority. That's why the language of self-creation is so interesting.
So why would a group that that says that it's speaking in the name of the people or in behalf of the people, why would a group be effective? Or when would such a group be effective, and might it not be effective?
It's very hard to theoretically determine what those conditions would be. You've put your finger on an interesting theoretical problem.
It was actually an accident, I assure you.
Because in the definition, I use the language of felicity, right? So these claims are felicitous, even though they break from established rules or procedures for representing popular voice. And I use the language of felicity is a very specific kind of philosophical language. It's associated with Austin's theory of speech acts. And what I'm interested in is the kind of indeterminate character of those claims. In other words, it would be very difficult to outline in advance of the claims themselves the sufficient conditions wherein they would be effective. There's something powerfully contingent or indeterminate. I'm interested in the claim, in the claim itself, and the kind of fraught nature of the claim, one made from the perspective of those who are claiming, right? Not from our perspective looking back kind of retrospectively and being able to retrospectively understand and elaborate the conditions in this or that context, but instead that there's always a kind of not fully determined nature to those kinds of democratic claims. So it's kind of, you know, run it up a flagpole and see who salutes. I'm interested in the in kind of capturing through a description of these moments a kind of powerful democratic indeterminacy. There's something about a democratic claim I want to argue in the book, kind of at a broader theoretical level, that that is inseparable from that experience of not being fully authorized, right, and therefore being kind of indeterminate, having opening up to a kind of unknown or unexpected futurity.
So there's a constituent moment involves a group that is not authorized, that's somehow outside the system, that is addressing in some way a political problem or a moment, and that group invokes the people in some way in its behalf.
Yeah, it doesn't always. I mean, one of the kind of organizing principles of the work, and I think hopefully something that's interesting, is that I think these constituent moments can occur in relatively formal political contexts, constitutional conventions. The Philadelphia Convention, I think, could be understood as an example of a constituent moment because the people that met in Philadelphia the summer of 1787 were not fully authorized to do what they set out to achieve.
Right. They were supposed to revise the Articles of the Confederation, and they came in and said, let's get rid of it and have something new.
Right. So that kind of the under-authorization of a constitutional convention that then produces a document that is retrospectively authorized by the people that gather and state ratifying conventions convened expressly for that purpose is an example of a kind of formal political institution that that enacts a constituent moment. The democratic republican societies are examples of political associations, but still formal, relatively formal political institutions. In the book, I'm interested not only in those formal moments, but also how the kind of dilemmas, what I refer to as kind of these dilemmas of popular authorization, also appear in very informal political contexts. Political oratory, I have a chapter on the political speeches of Frederick Douglass during the 1850s, Walt Whitman's claim to be the poet of the people. So political oratory, literature, I have a chapter on crowds, how debates around the legitimacy of crowd actions in a post-revolutionary context also seem to invoke or revolve around these dilemmas of authorization. I mean, a crowd doesn't only claim to be speaking on its own behalf, right, at least in a post-revolutionary American context, but claims to represent a larger symbolic or normative entity, the people. So it really comes down to this, this very powerful but kind of ambiguous figure of the people and the important role that it plays in American political discourse.
In these moments, whether it's an individual or a group, invoking the people, is the phrase "the people" used differently? Is it obvious what is meant by the people? Is there some significance in the invoking of the people?
There's a great significance in the invoking of the people, but the people is itself a very indeterminate category. So let me take a step back. One of the important kind of shifts in political thought, American political discourse over the course of the revolution, is that the people, this entity, are enthroned as the ground or the source of legitimate public authority, right? Now, this is not...
That they're sovereign.
They're sovereign. This is the emergence of a change in the discourse of popular sovereignty that occurs over the period. It's not that the colonists rebelling against British rule in the middle of the 1760s during the Stamp Act crisis already articulated a full vision of popular sovereignty. The American colonists, historians persuasively tell us, kind of backed into this position over the course of that decade. But 1776, Paine's Common Sense, you know, the Declaration of Independence, you have the emergence of a relative consensus around the legitimacy of popular sovereignty, that the people should be the ultimate ground of public authority. And this then sets the terms, right, for the debates that come after. What is deeply disagreed on, however, is how the people will be institutionally embodied, how the people will be represented, right? So you have a consensus around popular sovereignty, the authority of the people, and deep political disagreement over how that authority is represented. That's a real problem because the people, I say in the book, you know, they never speak in their own name.
Yeah.
The people never speak in their own name. The people are always produced through a representation of the people. And those representations are contestable, right?
Yeah,
I'll just say one more thing. I mean, I think that there is an interesting, there's almost like a kind of paradox, not kind of, I think it is a paradox, that underwrites these, and this is these dilemmas, and this is one moment where the historical work and the contemporary theoretical work come together. And that is, you can never determine who is a part of the people democratically by appeal to the people, right? Because the very premises of that question's the question itself undermines its premises, right? Because who are the people that are going to decide democratically over who? So there's a kind of indeterminacy around who gets to constitute the people, who, how they're going to be represented, how they're going to be institutionally embodied. And rather than seeing that as something to be deeply worried about, a kind of gap, right, at the heart of democratic legitimacy, I see it as an invitation to ever new claims to be included within that we the people.
So if the people are sovereign and power inheres in the people, then how is it that we invest so much authority in the founders?
Yeah. That is another very good question, Glenn. It's another very interesting historical and theoretical question. I guess it could be phrased as a tension between, you know, really between democracy and constitutionalism, right? So you can say, why is it that we at the beginning of the 21st century should feel, and this we being a we that believes in our own capacity to legislate for ourselves and to be self-determined politically, why is it that we are bound in very important ways to the decisions made by a very small group of white property men at the end of the 18th century? And, you know, theorists have different ways of going about resolving or trying to address that question. I mean, we're no longer traditionalists. We don't, you know, we're not Burkeans. We don't believe that authority legitimately resides in the mystic, you know, the depths of our tradition, but that we should be self-determined. So there are different theoretical ways of addressing that tension between constitutionalism and democracy, between the laws that structure democratic politics and the right of the people to be fully self-determining.
Jefferson talked about the dead hand of the past,
exactly.
And he talked about it not binding
exactly
any more than one generation, that maybe
right.
every 20 years or 25 years, 19, that maybe each time we should, in the modern language, sunset everything that had been dictated or determined by one generation and start from scratch.
No, it's a great example. So in other words, it's not only contemporary theorists that wrestle with this problem, right? I mean, some theorists try to say it's the extraordinary wisdom of the founding generation. They set the terms of our political discourse, and for those reasons we should, you know, other theorists talk about pre-commitment and enabling constraints. We don't have to go into the details of those different approaches. But already in 1789 and 1790, this Jefferson, you have a very interesting exchange of letters between Jefferson and Madison. Right? So Jefferson writing, it's important to think about the context that they are both writing from. You know, Jefferson writes his letter that deals with the dead weight of the past, that the dead have no rights, that the earth belongs in usufruct to the living, et cetera, et cetera. From revolutionary France, he writes in September of 1789, kind of caught up in the heady enthusiasm of that summer and the possibilities of a revolution bringing about a new political world. Jefferson's argument, as you said, implies that the people, he in many of his letters, you know, writes about not treating constitutions like the Ark of the Covenant, right? Or not, he in the notes on the state of Virginia, he criticizes the magic that seems to attach to the word constitution. So he makes a very radical argument, as you said, every 19 years based on kind of actuary tables, that the people should not only be able to radically revise the institutions of governance under which they live, but it's not, the agency is not left up to the people
themselves. They should be compelled to do it.
They should be compelled. They should be compelled. Otherwise, inertia and habit.
Yeah, they just won't do it.
Right. So he writes this letter to Madison. Madison responds, you know, February of 1790, sometime early in 1790. You know, Constitution recent. It's fairly recent that there has been a successful ratification of the United States Constitution. The institutions are still perceived as somewhat fragile, right, invulnerable. And Madison does not have a whole lot of time for the radicalism of Jefferson's argument. I mean, in his response, he admits that for a philosophical legislator, you know, for somebody who's kind of approaching these things from a very abstract perspective, that there is some real persuasiveness to the arguments that Jefferson's making. But he pragmatically refuses.
Yeah.
And he, in doing so, he kind of reiterates some of the central arguments that he made writing as Publius in Federalist 49. But he's very dismissive of the kind of, like, think about that practically. And he's so invested, you know, Madison is the great architect of American political institutions, and thinking about how that principle could, he thinks it would not lead to a more robustly democratic or Republican government, but that it would lead to the collapse of Republican government.
And he may have been right.
He may have been right.
He may have been right. One of the things that I'm not myself a political theorist, and I don't even play one on TV, but one of the reasons I think that we need political theorists is that so many of us hold contradictory propositions simultaneously without really knowing that they're contradictory propositions.
Right.
And so for many of us, maybe for many of the people watching us talk today, we embrace the notion of the democratic sovereignty of the people,
mm-hmm.
and we embrace the notion of the authority of the Constitution
right.
and the authority of the Founding Fathers.
Right.
And so maybe we can try to explore this a little bit further by me asking you, have the Founders always been considered authoritative? Is this in 2008, as we're speaking, is this an unusual time for them to be considered as authoritative as we do or appear to?
Yeah, well, I think that the short answer is no. They've not always been considered as authoritative as we treat them now, not only within our political debates and discussions and our political discourse, and we can talk a little bit about that, but also in kind of constitutional jurisprudence, it's not always been this way. It's been a varied career You know, there's oftentimes taken to be an important question is how is it that in the wake of constitutional ratification, in the, around the period that, that Madison is writing to Jefferson, 1790, you have this remarkably vehement and fascinating debate over whether or not the Constitution should be ratified. You have the Federalists, you have the Anti-Federalists, deep disagreement. The Constitution is by no means self-evident that's going to be successfully ratified when you're thinking about these things from the perspective of the participants. But in the wake of this deep debate, right, a debate that touches on really core, you know, fundamental questions of how to organize your political life. Quite, you know, it's always amazing for me in reading those ratification debates how quickly they move from kind of relatively particular kind of superficial policy concerns to a great depth, you know, fundamental rights, questions of how to organize fundamentally a Republican polity. But in the wake of that deep division, all of a sudden, this is the so the story goes, you have the myth of the kind of sanctity of the Constitution. Once it's ratified, its sanctity is agreed upon by all,
yeah,
and those founding figures are kind of immediately held to be what Jefferson would later call an assembly of demigods. Right? And it's not exactly true. Our colleague Michael Kamen has written a book on A Machine That Would Go of Itself, which really takes on this question, I think, in an interesting way, and shows the variability. So, you know, how the, you know, sometimes the founders, their capital is up, and sometimes sometimes it's down. An interesting period for me in American history, and it's not a period that I'm, I don't claim any kind of expertise on this period, but the Progressive Era, a kind of late 19th, early 20th century, you see very interesting debates.
A lot of debunking.
Of the authority of the founders, and this is in part, I mean, it can be explained politically. You know, in the 1790s and the early 20th century, you have the Supreme Court, a very conservative Supreme Court, a very activist Supreme Court, but not activist in the liberal sense of judicial activism, activist in a deeply conservative sense, preventing state legislatures from passing laws that would regulate the economy, for example. So you have a real political reaction to what is seen as the confinement that the Constitution has confined the ability of the people to pass laws to address the economic and social concerns of their day.
Yeah, and a number of progressives in that period, of course, revealed or argued that the founders protected
Absolutely.
Their own property interests, their
Absolutely.
Own personal interests in that document, and that document therefore should not only be seen as the product of a moment,
right,
but as the product of a particular class of people
Exactly.
in opposition to the people,
yeah, so
in some sense.
You get a very interesting example of how, let's say, the historiography of a period, because you're talking about progressive era historians, so Parrington, Cornell's own Carl Becker.
Charles Beard,
crucially. They don't exist in a vacuum from their political time, and you get the emergence of a kind of historiography around the founding period that, far from being hagiographic, is deeply deflating. So
yeah.
Beard writes an economic interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, which makes an argument that, you know, not only were the founders not the virtuous, wise men more hagiographic approaches had taken them to be. But as you said, they're working in their economic interest, that the Constitution was a kind of coup by one commercial class over recently enfranchised, the lower orders recently enfranchised by the Revolution, and that it enshrined things like property rights as a way of protecting that class's interests. Right now, that's a deeply, deeply deflationary of the authority of the founders. But it's not just the historians writing the period. I think it's interesting to look at, you know, if you think about how the authority of the founders is appealed to in a much more widely available kind of public discourse, the debates we have around politics. Well, you know, I mean, even Teddy Roosevelt had problems with the kind of confinements of the Constitution in this period. It wasn't just a far left fringe, right?
Jason, would it be fair to say that we should associate people who believe in the authority of the founders with conservatism, and people who are debunkers or skeptical of the authority of the founders as liberals or progressives?
Yeah, I think that's very misleading. I think from our perspective, from our little place in time,
it looks that way a little bit in 2008.
Because, right, and for good reason, right? You have, you know, as we mentioned, the kind of the emphasis on original intent or originalism in constitutional jurisprudence, which is clearly associated with a conservative approach to constitutional.
Justice Scalia, among others.
Scalia's textualism, Thomas's originalism. There, so there's that. But you know, you also have the emergence of you know, what some historians have and others have called founder chic. You know, you have in the past 10 years. The remarkable appearance of biographies, you know, David McCullough's biography of John Adams, for example, which was turned into that wonderful miniseries on HBO, Chernow's biography of Hamilton, the writings of Ella, Richard. There's a number, you know, the founders have really emerged again within not just academic quarters, but, you know, more broadly. And the founders that have emerged or that are most valued have been the conservative founders. Kind of John Adams is up and Thomas Jefferson is down, but it's not always been that way at all. I think one of the interesting things in looking at how the authorities of the founders, the authority of the founders has been appealed to at different moments in American history is that authority has been appealed to by wildly divergent ideological by people holding wildly divergent ideological positions.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, one of the difficulties for anybody who's going to, you know, invoke the authority of the founders is, just to give one simple example, we have the Hamiltonian legacy, and we have the Jeffersonian legacy.
Herbert Crowley.
If you invoke the authority of both,
then
you're invoking the authority of people who disagreed profoundly with one another. And how do you work yourself out of that box?
Right. Well, that's an interesting example also from the progressive era. You know, Crowley's attempt, he has a kind of ambiguous relationship to the authority of the founders in his great book, The Promise of American Life. But how he tries to navigate it is by clear, you know, and it's not just him, but he makes this argument very clear, I think, the Jeffersonian tradition versus the Hamiltonian tradition. He wants to kind of unite them in some way. But the founders were not of one mind, right? So I guess what I'm hearing in the question that you're asking, and this is something that I emphasize in some of the courses that I teach when I teach this period.
And you've taught also to alumni, right?
I have.
You've taught this to alumni.
I have. I taught a course for the CAU summer program, which was a very exhausting but fun week of teaching, on the uses and abuses of the American founding. And one of the things that we did is first tried to emphasize the fact that there is no single founding. There certainly is no single founding idea, but there's a great divergence of positions around kind of fundamental questions in late 18th century American politics. And that in part explains, in part, the very different uses to which the founders have subsequently been put.
We have just a few minutes remaining. This time is flying by.
Wow. It did go quickly.
Let's talk about a couple of those uses and abuses.
All right.
We've just gone through a pretty amazing presidential campaign, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or a conservative, a liberal, a radical. I think people have been fascinated by this campaign as much or more than any, certainly in my lifetime. Did the authority of the founders play some role? Were there uses and abuses of that authority that that you might single out in that campaign?
Yeah, I think so. First of all, I think in let's talk about the primaries maybe for a minute. As I was teaching this course at Cornell this summer, one of the periods that we focused on to think about the uses and abuses of the American founding was how contemporary Americans have debated the role of religion in public life. And the debates that occur around that question, really, it's amazing. They almost invariably situate themselves in relationship to how the founders envisioned, for example, the separation between church and state, how high that wall was intended to be built. So in the primaries, you know, I would say that you have two very interesting speeches on this question. Mitt Romney's speech on his religious faith and his Mormonism, and therefore and following from that, kind of broader reflections on the role of religion in American politics. And the second speech that I would want to compare that to is a speech that Obama gave very early, I think it's in the summer of 2006, to the Sojourners Group, that Christian magazine. He gave a speech on the call to renewal. Now, what's in Romney's speech is practically a lecture in American history. It really spends the bulk of its time talking about religious persecution, the 17th century kind of Puritan background. It doesn't emphasize a strong separation between church and state. But Romney wants to, in that speech, I think, make an argument about the importance in American history of religion, that religion always has undergirded political freedom in this country such that they are almost inseparable. You find something like this argument in Tocqueville's Democracy in America. But the effect of the speech is, of course, to draw another line between those people of faith, whatever their faiths may be, and the secular humanists who do not have faith. So he talks about secularism as itself a religion and should be treated as a religion. So that's one kind of approach. And as I said, American history and the founding authority is appealed to at some length in that speech. Now, Obama's speech also invokes that historical background, but his arguments, they're very surprising in some ways because he explicitly refuses to simply reiterate the high wall of separation between church and state. His speech was sometimes discussed in the media in relationship to John F. Kennedy's famous 1960 address to the Protestant ministers, where Kennedy kind of lays out the classic liberal secular argument, versions of which you can find in Jefferson or behind him in Locke. But Obama does not go there. Obama does not, in the course, I try to make an argument that what you see in his response is the emergence of maybe something like a post-secular liberalism. He refuses to take a kind of absolutist stance on the question of secularism, the secularism of the state, and instead talks about the impossibility of keeping religion out of the public realm,
yeah,
and the value of having religious perspectives as a part of our ongoing democratic conversation. And he certainly is on good historical grounds for making those arguments.
Well, yeah, that's what one I was going to observe, Jason, that it seems to me that the material is there in the past for people across the political spectrum to tap the founding generation,
yeah,
and to emerge with a plausible perspective that reflects the political agenda,
yeah,
which they would like to advance. To me, the more interesting question is why Americans of all people feel compelled to draw on,
yeah,
that generation to make their arguments,
yeah,
more persuasive. The French don't do that. The people from Sierra Leone don't do that. This seems to be, or maybe I should ask you, is it unique that are Americans unique in tapping the authority of the founders in the way that they do?
I wouldn't want to make a claim about, I wouldn't want to make an exceptionalist claim about American exceptionalism, about American exceptionalism. But I do think that one of, an interesting part of that question is, you know, it's not just the authority of the founders and the way that the founding authority has been appealed to by, you know, pro-slavery forces and abolitionists, by conservatives in the era of progressive economic reforms, and by the progressives themselves. But that, you know, you have a kind of this is about the persistence of an American exceptionalism. This is another issue that was raised in interesting ways, I think, in the presidential campaign. Not so much in the primaries, but in the general campaign. McCain regularly invokes the language, and we know exceptionalism, when I teach exceptionalism to my students, I turn it into a phrase, singular history with universal significance.
Right.
So the particular history of this country is not a history that is only significant to us, but it has a kind of global significance. We are a city on a hill, right? This is the John Winthrop kind of early articulation of this, but you get different historical versions of it, iterations of it. The Citadel of Liberty, the last bastion of defense against communism, et cetera. The great democratic hope. I mean, you just find it very much in the speeches of George Bush and his administration. But in the campaign, one of the things that was interesting about this question is that McCain regularly invokes, he would say things like, I believe in American exceptionalism. And Obama, too, has an exceptionalist account of America. I think it would be very difficult to run for the president of the United States and not have an exceptionalist.
And win.
But they gave this idea, different inflections, I would say. When Winthrop invoked the city on a hill, you know, it was an exceptional nation, a chosen people. We have entered into a covenant with the Lord. The Lord brings us across the Atlantic. It will then be up to us to fulfill our side of the covenant. So the emphasis of that exceptionalism and chosenness was really on the sacrifice and the duty required, right? Other versions of exceptionalism, and you get that sacrifice and duty version of exceptionalism most brilliantly captured in the speeches of Abraham Lincoln. There's another side of that exceptionalism, which is more triumphalist.
Yeah.
We are the exceptional nation.
And good stuff will come to us.
And good, we're here to spread the good news. And I do think that they're kind of slightly different inflections in the way the candidates invoked exceptionalism over the course of the campaign. I would make that argument. I think McCain's invocation was a bit more of the triumphalist, victory-oriented invocation. And Obama talks about sacrifice all the time.
Yeah.
I think that it was interesting to see that difference so clearly on display in their two campaigns.
And it'll be fascinating to see what the rhetoric is like in the new administration, especially given the challenges.
Absolutely.
And some of the calls for sacrifice. And, you know, you've really given us a lot to think about today, and perhaps you'll agree to come back and we can take a look at some of these issues with some new material from a new administration. So thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very much, Glenn.